Shouldn't take too long.
Good afternoon, colleagues. With that gavel, I have just convened the Subcommittee on Transportation and Economic Development for May the 31st, 2017. We are gathered today for the purpose of a public hearing and work session on Senate Bill 93 and a public hearing on House Bill 2290. And so I start with, okay. So I am going to open the public hearing and work session on Senate Bill 93. And ask our staff to give an introduction, and then we have a sign-up sheet. We have several people signed up. I didn't know if there were any that came in late, and you'd like to see the sign-up sheet returned so you could. I don't see any hands going up, so we'll turn it over to our professional staff and ask you to give us an introduction to the issue.
Co-chairs, members of the committee, SB 93 increases the amount that can be credited to the Workers' Memorial Scholarship Account. Those amounts come from civil penalties recovered by DCBS for workplace safety and health violations. Right now, there's a cap on the amount that can be deposited of $250,000, which wasn't changed, which hasn't changed since it was established in 1993. The bill increases the cap to $1 million. Interest from the fund is used for educational scholarships for spouses and children of workers who are killed on the job or have received a permanent total disability award from an injury on the job.
Thank you very much. Colleagues, any questions of the professional staff? I think we'll have, there are three people on the sign-in sheet. We'll ask them to all come up together. The legendary Mr. Shipwreck, Michael Wood from OSHA, and Ms. Earl from AOI. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
And I am an agnostic as to batting order, so.
Let's start with Michael.
Okay. Chair Johnson, Chair Gomberg, members of the committee, my name for the record is Michael Wood. I'm the administrator of the Occupational Safety and Health Division of the Department of Consumer and Business Services, which we refer to as Oregon OSHA. And SB 93 is here before you at our request. We administer the Workers' Memorial Scholarship Fund. And one of the things that has struck us in recent years is that we have been able to continue to offer these scholarships, but in the last several years, the average scholarship we've been able to give has been $1,200. And $1,200 is meaningful and certainly is appreciated by the people who receive it, but when you think in terms of the cost of college today, it's not really material in the sense that it isn't going to it isn't likely to make the difference between whether or not someone goes to college, which was sort of part of the original vision behind the establishment of this fund. So we are proposing that we be given the ability to increase the principal from $250,000 up to $1 million, and then we would continue to use the earnings off that money set aside in that account to pay out the scholarships. The proposal is actually fairly straightforward. That is the entire substance of it, and I'll let these folks talk about why they see that as a good idea unless you have any immediate questions for me.
Thank you, Mr. Wood. Colleagues, any questions? I have one for you, Mr. Wood. We have many new members, new to Ways and Means and also new to the body. And for some of us, a little refreshment is not a bad thing. As far as the administration of the grants, what kinds of institutions of higher learning are eligible to receive funds that are supporting the students that you're able to help? And what degree of oversight? How do you make sure that if you give young Mr. Shipwreck a scholarship that he is fulfilling any obligations associated with the scholarship, a certain grade point or showing up at class, or is there any kinds of courses that are specified for the grant recipients?
Chair Johnson, that's a good question. The basic oversight for the scholarships, as is the case with all Oregon scholarships, is through the Oregon Student Assistance Commission. And there aren't particular performance standards affiliated with these scholarships, but if individuals obviously don't perform, they don't continue to get the scholarships. It's an annual decision about whether or not they're granted. They don't, they need to use the money toward the higher education during those periods. Over the years, we've given scholarships to folks at community colleges. We've given them to state institutions. We've also given them to some folks in private colleges. They basically are available for anybody who's pursuing higher education at an accredited institution.
Thank you. Co-Chair Gromberg.
Thank you, Co-Chair. Good afternoon, everyone. We've talked to quite a bit in this committee about delinquent debt, and I know in your agency we're carrying about $59 million in uncollected debt. I don't have a clear sense of how much of that may stem from violations and how we're doing on the violation front in general. So what's the pool of money that we're talking about drawing from, and how are we doing in terms of collecting those dollars when they're owed?
Co-Chair Gromberg, Co-Chair Johnson, I don't know the answer to the question about the amount of delinquent debt that is payable to OSHA. The reason for that is that we don't see ourselves as being a revenue-producing agency. Although we do assess penalties, the purpose of those penalties is to motivate behavior and to deter violations. So we don't focus on the revenue end. I know roughly how much we bring in, and it's a small percentage of what comes into the premium assessment operating account overall. I do know that there are a significant number, and I can get you certainly the exact detail, there's a significant number of penalties that go unpaid. Part of the reason for that is that we assess a lot of our penalties against LLCs and corporations, particularly in the small construction industry. And in most, in many cases, if there are significant penalties owed, it is simpler for them to simply close up their doors, and then there is no entity from which we can actually effectively pursue collection. So in a very real sense, the penalties have served their purpose in terms of driving the behavior and encouraging people who stay in the business to comply, but the money isn't necessarily readily collectable in the sense that a debt would be if there was a continuing entity from whom we could collect it.
Representative Noble.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. To follow up on Co-Chair's question, you mentioned higher education. Is it available for any vocational training or trades?
Representative Noble, Co-Chair Johnson, I do not know the answer to the question about whether it would be available for post-secondary vocational education. I can certainly get that, but I don't want to guess. And at this point, I'm not absolutely certain of what the answer to that question is. I don't know. It's possible that Mr. Shipwreck knows the answer to that question.
Not as far okay. as your fund. I can't answer that
okay.
either.
Thank you.
If you would find out and get that back to the professional staff, I think with the heavy emphasis on career and technical in this building right now, that would be an important thing to have us know. All right. That concludes your testimony.
It does.
Ms. Earls? Mr. Shipwreck?
Go ahead, Betsy.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Betsy Earls, representing Associated Oregon Industries and Oregon Business Association. I feel like Bob should probably go first because I think that he was in on the original construction of this Worker Memorial Scholarship Fund.
As he was on the drafting of the Magna Carta.
Exactly.
And other important historical documents.
Exactly. So...
You want me to go away?
Why don't you?
He had the last three of the Seven Commandments.
I'm getting old. Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Bob Shipwreck. Spent many years in this building representing the Oregon Building Trades Council. I'm retired electrician and currently president of a group called Kids Chance of Oregon. It's part of a national group that supplies scholarships, again, for kids who have lost a parent due to an industrial accident or are permanently and totally disabled. We've awarded six scholarships so far. This is all private sector money. I should tell you a little bit about our group. It's kind of like the Oregon Way. It's a labor management group. We have physicians, insurers, attorneys from both sides of the bar sit on the board, and we're actively working. I should mention people with OSHA and the Workers' Comp Ombudsman are on our board. We work closely with OSHA on with their scholarships, trying to identify kids that would be eligible. Let me just tell you from my experience about the need here. We've done a lot of work on workers' compensation, dramatically raised benefits, made the workplace more safe, lowered premiums for employers. It's been a real remarkable success story. But these kids are now, they're past the age of 18. They no longer get any money from the state because of the accident of support for these kids. And I got to tell you, it's not much anyway. So going to college is a real challenge for these kids. Most of the people that I've met, all their parents are still single. They've got, you know, brothers and sisters. It's tough. This really makes a difference in these kids' lives. Our group, by the way, to answer Representative Noble's question, we absolutely do or will pay for vocational education. We try and be as broad as possible. And in fact, we'll even help with transportation, books, rent, whatever it takes to keep a kid in school. We monitor their progress just as OSHA does. And we also use the OSA. Well, we will be using the OSAC to scholarship folks. I'm here mainly Betsy's correct. I did work on this bill in 93. This was following the workers' comp reforms of 1990. There was a lot of emphasis at that time on prevention of injuries and accidents. Again, both labor and management recognized that we had a safety problem. There was fine money coming in, and we thought at the time, the two sides, that it would be a very good thing to use the interest off this account to provide these scholarships because of the need. So I'm here to let you know about us and ask you if you ever see a constituent of yours which might have children that might be eligible for these, to please let us know. It's available, and they just probably wouldn't go to school without this. They really need it. Thank you.
Thank you, colleagues. Any questions for Mr. Shiprack? Now, Ms. Earls.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Again, for the record, Betsy Earls representing Associated Oregon Industries and Oregon Business Association. AOI was also involved with Mr. Shiprack in the beginning of the Worker Memorial Scholarship Fund and the setting up of that fund. It was my former colleague, who some of you know, Carl Frederick, who worked with the group on putting that together. And we have been more or less, AOI has more or less ever since had a seat on the advisory committee to Oregon OSHA that helps administer and make determinations about who gets the scholarships from the Worker Memorial interest money. So, you know, I know that all of you in this building know that education is one of the greatest economic levers that a person can have to lift somebody out of poverty or out of any situation that they find themselves in. And we particularly see the children of injured workers or deceased workers in situations more of poverty more often because they have lost a primary breadwinner in the family. So the intention of the Worker Memorial Scholarship Fund was to help lever those kids that are able to apply for a scholarship for this money, receive it, and go to college to continue to move up in the world, hopefully in the same way that they might have if they had had their parent, the primary breadwinner or a breadwinner of the family at all, still at home making money. So as a member of the CTAC committee that administers the grants, I've watched the effectiveness of the awards we can give diminish over the years. They are still meaningful, but I think at this point a lot of times the amount of money we can give maybe covers books. And books are expensive, but that is not going to, you know, make as much difference as we had hoped when the fund was set up to move people upward and onward in their career trajectory or education trajectory. So We've increased the size of the fund once, and it's well past time, in AOI's opinion, to increase it again and help these workers' children move onward and upward in their education. So AOI and OBA urge your support of this increase.
Thank you very much. Senator Hansel.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. Just a couple of quick questions more on administration stuff. How long will it take, in your estimate, to cap it at a million? If my understanding is that penalties that are raised go into this. Is that right? Is that how, or maybe a little explanation where the money comes from for this?
Co-Chair Johnson, Senator Hansel, that's a good question. It we bring in penalty revenue about $1.5 million a year. So even if we, you know, if we diverted all of that in a single year, we could, over the course of a year, raise the principal to the full $1 million. I think that in terms of just prudence, we probably would do it a little more slowly than that. I would estimate that we would be 2 to 3 years out in terms of just moving a portion of the penalty money over.
Follow up. What happens to those penalty revenue otherwise?
Co-Chair Johnson, Senator Hansel, the penalty revenue is otherwise deposited in the premium assessment operating account, and it's used in the same way that other funds available in that account are used to fund by appropriation to fund the activities of Oregon OSHA, the Workers' Compensation Division, the Workers' Compensation Board, some other activities at DCBS, and some activities at OHSU.
Once the money is in the scholarship fund, is it accessible for people to rob it, or you know, pull it out or sweep it or whatever?
Co-Chair Johnson, Senator Hansel, once it is in the fund, we would consider the money to not be available for our expenditure from the premium assessment operating account. As far as other actions that might be taken by bodies with authority to make the law, I wouldn't be able to answer that question.
Thank you. Representative Meek.
Thank you, Co-Chair. So it seems like this is more of a foundation kind of setup where the principal stays there and you're able to allocate the scholarships and help based on the interest accrued or the gain that's, you know, the funds gained after above and beyond the initial deposit, which is currently $250,000.
Co-Chair Johnson, Representative Meek, that's correct. And yes, it's essentially an endowment or an endowed foundation.
Follow up. So one of the questions I have is, it seems like you're able to help five families per year over the last 7 years or so. How many applications do you have for these funds?
Co-Chair Johnson, Representative Meek, we get 2 to 3 dozen applications, but once those are screened for the basic level of eligibility, which is that it be dependent of someone who was covered by the Oregon Workers' Compensation System and either suffered a permanent total disability or was killed on the job, then that number ends up being 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. And in recent years, we have generally been able to give at least a modest scholarship to every applicant, although our ability to continue to do that, particularly if there's not a change in the principal, would obviously be in question.
Follow up.
Because my question would be, why don't we shoot for $2 million if we're a foundation, and so you have a little more funds and availability and more of a meaningful scholarship than just $1,200 is grateful and thankful. But it's, as we all know, and you know, cost of colleges and higher education is going up, and that would be my thought. So.
Representative Noble.
Thank you. I have a question really to follow up on Senator Hansel. The money that then will be allocated to the scholarship, will we be asked to backfill that money for operations with your organization?
Co-Chair Johnson, Representative Noble, no.
Thank you.
All right, colleagues, any other remaining questions? Thank you very much. All right, no one else is signed up to testify. I don't know whether the spirit of testimony moved over the crowd and anybody wants to rush forward. Okay, there being none, then I am going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 93 and open a work session on Senate Bill 93. Co-Chair Gomberg.
Co-Chair Johnson, I move Senate Bill 93 to the full committee with a do pass recommendation.
Colleagues, you have heard Representative Gomberg's motion. Any questions? Any discussion? Any objection? So ordered. We will need carriers.
I'll carry. I volunteer.
We've got Senator Hansel to full in the Senate. And Representative Meek to the House. All right, I will close the work session on Senate Bill 93.
Excuse me, Co-Chair, who's going to take two Ways and Means?
Senator Hansel.
Okay, I don't know if we designated that as well, but yes.
And I will open a public hearing on House Bill 2290 relating to fees imposed by the Department of Transportation. We have the changing of the professional staff, and welcome Mr. Joe Levette. And we have Team ODOT. Was there a sign-up sheet for them? Thank you, Mr. Shipwreck.
Thank you.
While the Team ODOT is assembling, I will ask Mr. Joe Levette to introduce us to the issue.
Madam Chair and members, House Bill 2290 is the DMV cost recovery bill. Bill proposes to raise a number of fees to begin to close the gap between the cost of DMV products and services and the actual revenue that's being generated. One note I would make about this is that this bill doesn't have anything to do with the transportation funding package. This is really about funding DMV services so that the State Highway Fund wouldn't be subsidizing DMV operations to the extent that it is now.
Thank you very much. We welcome Mr. McClelland and Ms. Joyce.
Thank you very much. Co-Chair Johnson, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Tom McClelland. I'm the DMV administrator with the Department of Transportation, and I'm here to testify on House Bill 2290-A. I think, as you know, part of the mission of DMV is to collect revenues for the State Transportation Fund. And we do that primarily through DMV fees that are charged to the public, and most of those fees are set in statute. The bill proposes to raise fees to more closely recover costs that we have in a number of areas, and also is looking to streamline and to create more consistency in a number of the fees that we do charge to the public. The net effect of this bill is about $3 million per year. It has a July 1, 2018 effective date in it, so we're anticipating about a year to implement, but thereafter would be about $3 million per year in revenue. The fees that we collect are primarily for three main purposes. One is obviously to collect the direct and indirect costs of running DMV, the operating costs of our division. It also provides funding for the infrastructure debt service over many years of transportation investment packages. There have been a number of bonds issued for construction packages. Quite a bit of our fees are used to repay that debt, and then to collect revenue for the State Highway Fund and for cities and counties as well. Most of
Mr.
the fees
McClellan,
that
I'm going to stop you because I know this pretty well, and you've got me thoroughly confused. So you want to recover the cost of operations. You're going to raise about $3 million. And are you now saying that these fees would be applied to infrastructure debt service and contributions to the State Highway Fund?
No, Co-Chair Johnson, all I'm doing is giving you background, actually, as far as what our fees are used for generally.
Oh, okay.
So I apologize for leading you astray.
So I was going to say, given ODOT's current bonded indebtedness, $3 million is like a rounding error.
Yes, yes. And as far as the cost recovery goes, this doesn't bring us to complete cost recovery. This is a, more of a step in that direction. So we're bringing this forward to you.
As long as I've interrupted you, the obvious question, if this isn't complete cost recovery, this is like throwing somebody drowning 10 feet offshore, 6 feet a rope. What's the delta? And when was the last time you raised fees? And if you're not effectuating complete cost recovery now, when's the next time you're going to want to do this?
Co-Chair Johnson, it's been many years since our division has brought forward any kind of fee increases to deal with cost increases. You've seen many increases since 2001, since we started having Oregon OTIA-type bills passed. A number of bills have passed with fee increases, but the money has all been dedicated for other purposes, not really for the operations of DMV. It's been very rare over the years that DMV has actually brought anything forward to you as far as a fee increase for cost purposes. So the net effect of that is, when certain parts of your portfolio are not bringing in enough money to cover those costs, the cash cows, the other things that you're collecting revenue on, the primarily vehicle registration and vehicle titles, that money is filling holes in the operational areas of DMV and not going to fill potholes elsewhere around the state.
That's a management decision, though. I mean, you consciously chosen in many cases to sell below cost and make it up in volume. And I'm trying to figure out how long ago was it that you asked for a cost recovery fee, and why wait so long if you're selling below cost?
Senator Johnson, I don't know. I haven't been with the agency that long to be able to say. I've been 21 years. And in that period of time, we have not brought anything forward as far as a cost increase for you. We do have steps we have to go through to gain approval for that. And I believe since we've started doing these studies about 5 years ago, it's been really incumbent upon us to bring this information forward to you as a body to decide if you want to raise these types of fees or continue to raise the registration, the title, those other fees that are used for transportation funding packages.
Okay, I should have let you finish your presentation. Go ahead, please.
Most of the fees were originally set to recover costs. And we've gone back to actually 1971, even before Senator Monroe, I think, was in the legislature.
There was a time.
And we found a budget note back in 1971 that directed our agency to do cost studies before we brought forward any fee increases. That had a dampening effect, apparently, because there were not many fee increases brought forward from DMV to the legislature after that point in time. When I arrived, we were not doing cost studies even. The first one we did was in 2013, and that was a pretty comprehensive look, an activity-based looked at over 70 different products and services that we issue, and did a complete analysis of direct, indirect, and overhead types of costs, and applied those to the things that we issue, the products we deliver and services that we have. And it revealed a very large deficit. And we've brought that forward a few times. But what it gets masked, though, with the increases for the OTIA and the Jobs and Transportation Act. That additional revenue has been brought in and has kind of hidden this problem that I see in the cost of our services and the fees to recover that. So we did the study in 2013. What we found were a number of places where services did not have fees in statute for us to charge anything. So there, in this bill right now, there are some places where we're proposing some fees that are comparable to similar types of services. The biggest area where we have deficits are in the driver program areas. Driver licensing, driver testing, suspensions with revocations of driving privileges. Those are the areas where we have the biggest deficit overall as a division. And again, it's the vehicle registration fees that make up the difference in those areas. We found that some of our fees, because they are so low, have caused some unintended consequences. One of those examples would be the plate transfer fees, which is in House Bill 2290. It's currently $6. You can take a plate, you may find a plate, you may buy a plate online. If it still has valid registration, it can be put on your vehicle in lieu of paying $86 for 2 years of registration. It's also sometimes used to avoid DEQ. So your vehicle won't pass emissions, but you can get by for a few years with that plate transfer. So at $6, it creates a real incentive for people to go that route. This bill proposes that $6 at least be raised to $20. We've looked at a number of our CDL skills test endorsements, and we want to have a consistent fee there. So there's a constant $70. That does not recover our costs for that particular service, but at least moves us in that direction, and also the consistency. We have a couple of fees that we're lowering by 50 cents, so we have at least have a rounded number. Instead of $23.50, we're proposing $23. It's a little less cash, change to worry about there.
Why don't you round up?
It's up to you. House Bill 2290A also directs the department to conduct a cost of services study every 2 years. We'll probably do it anyway, but at least it directs us to do the study and bring that back to you on the odd-numbered year. So you have that information. Whether you act upon it or not is up to you. But we can bring that, you can do the study, provide the information, you can decide where you think some kind of adjustments and fees should take place. This bill does not address our records fees. Those are mostly set in administrative rule. And we've decided to set that aside for a period until we determine if that is something, this cost recovery idea is something you want us to pursue more broadly. Because the records area, we don't think many of our fees are recovering costs there as well. But again, they're set in rule, they're not set in statute. But we've set that aside. The bill, as originally introduced, would have raised about $17 to $18 million per year. On the House Transportation Policy Committee, they removed a number of fees. They lowered some fees. So the version you see today, like I said, is about $3 million per year. And again, moves us toward that cost recovery idea. And also has a little bit of that streamlining and house cleaning basically around fees. So.
Questions, colleagues? Senator Representative Nierman.
Thanks, Madam Chair. So in light of the fact that right now we have the service transformation program going on, the cost recovery numbers are likely to change, and I would think and I would hope significantly. I hope that STP is going to make your department way more efficient. So right now, your fee increases are based on what your calculations are now for what it costs to crank out a title or to do a plate replacement or whatever. But that's a little bit unfair, don't you think? I mean, it's like saying I'm going to do the trip analysis based on the Wright brothers, but a couple years from now we're going to wheel in a 747, and so things could be a little bit different. So do we need to wait until after STP is launched to kind of do a fair cost analysis, and maybe even a little bit after STP is launched?
So Co-Chair Johnson, Representative Nierman, we're going to do this study every 2 years. And with that information, we got a nice baseline now. So as we do our service transformation, as we change the way we do our business and we have savings in certain areas, and some areas may actually cost us a little more, we'll be able to provide that information to you. And it may reveal that certain services, the cost has actually gone down and the fee can be adjusted at that point. I think the wonder of doing these studies every 2 years is that we can provide you information. Mm-hmm. And so you can see over time what the effect of the changes are. This investment in technology primarily that we're asking you to help support will allow us to make some improvements, and then we can measure the effect. Now, it's going to be a few years. As you know, it's mm-hmm. This is not a snap your fingers and it's going to happen. I wish it would. It's going to take us several years, and then we start to see the effect, the benefits. And like I said, some things will be higher, but many things I would hope would be actually lower.
Good. Thank you.
What's the cost of the study?
It's internal staff, Co-Chair Johnson. We use internal staff. We've had some volunteers from Willamette University, from the graduate school, have taken a look at our methodology and given us some advice there. We've not used consultants at all. We've used just our own staff. We have good accounting information and time measurement, actually, work measurement. We do a lot of timings, stopwatch-type timings over years, and that's something that we use as far as estimating costs on things.
And Chair Johnson and members, Amy Joyce from the department as well, to add to what Tom said, the first year that we did the cost study in 2013, there was a large oversight group, including the Willamette University folks, and also a member from LFO. So we had some broad involvement as well, but no paid paid consultant or anything of that nature.
So currently, a portion of the cost of DMV is being drawn from the highway fund.
Coacher Johnson, Senator Monroe, you could say that because the registration fee is really what's being used to cover those costs before it gets allocated to the cities and counties and the highway fund. So it would otherwise be going to the roads. Yes?
So if you get this fee increase so that you're fully funded by the fees, that would in essence have the impact of putting more money in the highway fund.
Yes, that is true.
Thank you.
Representative Meek.
Thank you, Co-Chair. Well, I just wanted to thank you, Mr. McClellan and Mrs. Joyce. I think that's great work and a great way to use the information that you receive through these studies and being proactive to help us to, you know, basically justify any increases based on the current level of service you're providing and making it fair and equitable to all folks that are using those services. And I thank you for your work.
Thank you.
Representative Noble.
Thank you, Co-Chair. Along with Representative Meek, you know that I was also on the Transportation Policy Committee in the House and
yes.
had some questions and reservations more as to the desperate impact this may cause to people with less means going through housing issues, food issues, and other economic issues. More just wanted to, I appreciate the time you spent with him yesterday. My position hasn't changed, my concerns about raising fees in general right at this point, but I appreciate you the work you're doing and you being here.
Representative Nierman.
Thank you. I kind of like the idea of the DMV being self-funded. Are there other states that do that, that just through their fees self-fund the DMV? Do you know?
Co-Chair Johnson, Representative Nierman, probably. I can't speak definitively about that because they're funded so many different ways. Some are in their general fund. We're not, you know, so it's really broad. I think most of them do try to operate within their fees that they charge, at least to break even. And in states like ours, you've got also an obligation to raise more so that there's a profit component that is used for the transportation system.
Yeah.
Follow up, or was that responsive?
No, that was good.
Colleagues? Ms. Joyce, did you have independent testimony, or are you just flying low cover here?
Chair Johnson, I'm just here to provide Tom's support.
All right. Colleagues, any other questions? Representative Reardon.
Just a brief comment. Thank you, Co-Chair. Just I when I looked at the fees as presented, I really thought that they were kind of modest and wouldn't have a very great impact on anybody. And the ones that were raised the most in general seem to have something to do with getting a new job where you might anticipate greater income. So I really didn't think that it would be that harmful to any individual. So,
well, you've given me a perfect setup.
but there may be other points of view. Who knows?
Contemplated in the transportation package that is lumbering its way through this process are a number of fee increases. We will undoubtedly, independently, be asked how do these fees fit in with the proposed fee increases in the proposed transportation package?
Chair Johnson, I think we're not supposed to see an actual draft bill until about 4 o'clock this afternoon, but my understanding
is... Yes, the U-Haul will be pulling from the building individual copies.
But my general understanding of the package are the kinds of fees the DMV charges that might be raised in the package would be around the typical registration and title. And I think in this list of fees, there may be perhaps one change to a registration amount, and it really has to do with an error. It was something that was missed in the JTA. So today, to register your regular passenger vehicle, it's $86 every 2 years. But if you've got a small motorhome, it's only $54 every 2 years. It was a simple error in the JTA. So that's one that goes up. But otherwise, most of these things are around the driver's side of things, and it is my understanding so far those are not included in the package being drafted.
All right. Any concluding remarks? We thank you very much for your testimony. And Mr. Jolivet, any comments before I close the public hearing? Okay. I'm going to close.
Thank you.
Do you need to, oh, after you close them, we'll do the cameras.
I'm not going to take photos.
All right, colleagues, I'm closing the public hearing on House Bill 2290 relating to fees charged by the department or imposed by the Department of Transportation. This was only scheduled for a public hearing, so there won't be any other action by the committee. Mr. Jolivet tells us that there is nothing else that the committee needs to contemplate today. So I would invite any comments for the good of the order.
Madam Co-Chair, I think members should rest up over the weekend because it's going to be a busy next week.
Thank you very kindly, Co-Chair Gumberg, for that well-timed admonition. Colleagues, we're adjourned.